Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 35, and today I'm joined by Sean Kirkland, assistant professor of philosophy at DePaul University. Sean's work focuses on ancient philosophy, phenomenology, 19th and 20th century continental philosophy, as well as range of other philosophical issues. He has, I'll mention just a couple of his recent publications that are particularly relevant to our discussion today. The Tragic Foundation of Aristotle's Ethics, which is published in the Graduate Faculty Philosophy Journal. Logos as Message from the Gods on the Etymology of Hermes in Plato's Cratylus, which is published in Bochumer Philosophische Jahrbuch für Antike und Mittelalter, and that's volume 12. We'll post that up on the web. And on Anti-Parmenidean Temporality in Aristotle's Physics, which was published in 2007 in FOK. These are just a few of his many publications. But he's joined me today to talk about a book project he's working on, I think coming close to completing, which is entitled Ontology and Self-Knowledge in Plato's Early Dialogues. Is that still the title?
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's the title. Thanks so much for having me, Chris. I really appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
Oh, it's great to have you. So we're here at the APS here in Michigan State. We got a chance to talk a little bit. So maybe you could begin by telling us a little bit about the book project, and sort of the
idea. Sure. Yeah. So the book, which is nearly complete. It's entitled The Ontology or Ontology and Self-Knowledge in Plato's Early Dialogues, and the focus of that of the study is Socratic method, or the what I take to be the more or less consistent method of philosophizing that we find in those dialogues that are generally agreed to be from Plato's early period.
Right.
And so those that are often referred to as the Socratic dialogues, the aporetic dialogues, etc. And in the book, what I try to thematize are, well, two aspects of that Socratic project. One is what is often referred to as the Socratic question, that is the what is X question.
Right.
And so I try to take that very seriously and to think of Socratic questioning as focused in an ontological way. That is, it's focused on what virtue is, or on the being of virtue,
right,
being of human virtue, or some aspect of virtue, courage, sofra sune, temperance, etc.
Right.
And so that's what Socratic questioning is aimed at, right? The being of virtue, or what virtue is. So the question that the book poses is, what is the, or the first question that the book poses is, what is the ontology that is at work in that mode of Socratic questioning, that thematizing of the being of virtue, and his differentiation of the being of virtue from the way it initially appears to us, from our opinions about it, from etc. So that's the first aspect of Socratic method throughout all the early dialogues that I think is consistent. He's always asking a what is X question or some variation of it. And then the second aspect of the Socratic method is that it always ends in aporia, or waylessness, or frustration. And so my aim is to try to figure out, if we take that very seriously and take Socrates' commitment to that philosophical method very seriously, then we have to ask ourselves, what conception of being is properly or best revealed or best brought to light in that ultimately frustrated mode of questioning? And I think what we end up with then is a really radical ontology, that is, an ontology of something that is essentially question-worthy. So it doesn't exist as a present entity. What virtue is doesn't exist as any kind of present entity, I think, in the early dialogues for Socrates' questioning, which would ultimately best be captured or most truthfully rendered in a propositional definition,
right?
Listing its characteristics, its essential characteristics, or something like that. Instead, for Socrates, I believe, in the early dialogues, the most truthful mode of discourse for what virtue is the question itself. That's the way we capture the being of virtue, is in the question, not in the propositional right. definition.
So there, well, a couple of things emerge out of that. Mm-hmm. I want to focus first. Let's focus first on this issue of strangeness, because you right. bring at the beginning in the introductory yeah. chapter, yeah. you highlight the importance of the distance yeah. between us and Socrates,
yeah.
the distance between. And divided as it is by the sort of Cartesian subjectivity yep. and the whole yep. modern turn.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that strangeness, because you're getting at it right. already with the questionableness. And
yeah. So my idea is that although Socrates always appears to everyone who reads the dialogues, I think, as strange in certain ways.
Sure.
I mean, you know... there's a kind of a degree or a depth of strangeness that I think has oftentimes been overlooked, especially in what I take to be the orthodox or sort of most prevalent, most dominant philosophical approach to reading the dialogues,
mm-hmm.
that is the Anglo-American or analytic tradition of reading the dialogues. And so what I suggest is that there's a kind of strangeness to Plato's early Socrates that has not been recognized, and that is this this radical ontology that is at work in his questioning, such that for that early Socrates, that aporetic condition is not merely an epistemological failure.
Mm-hmm.
It is, in fact, I think, the moment in which what virtue is presents itself to us as what it is. That
mm-hmm.
is, it presents itself to us truthfully in the aporetic moment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not merely an epistemologic failure.
But is it just the aporetic moment, or is it the it is in part it's our orientation toward that open-endedness of
right.
the question, or
right.
the end, maybe, this is related, obviously, to Socrates' own concern about mythology and
right.
other kinds of things, right,
right.
in the Phaedo, where
right.
he's worried about what happens when you habituate
right.
one another
yeah, yeah.
to living in a continually frustrated way,
yeah,
namely
yeah.
pursuing these questions,
right.
always being disappointed about never having that
right.
answer.
Yeah, yeah. That's
so,
right.
And this is related to some of the things I've been trying to think about, namely, what are the virtues that are cultivated
right.
by orienting us in that way toward questioning in that way that
right.
will
right.
that will also that's really focused on our own
yep.
limitations or maybe on the limits of the
yep.
nature of the human condition or something.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's good. I think that's right, Chris, to emphasize some that quasi-positive aspect of the Socratic project. So I think the essence of the Socratic project lies in its refutation, its elenchic character. But I think so my idea would be that the protreptic moment,
mm-hmm.
the turning toward virtue, turning toward
right.
the being of virtue specifically.
Right.
So turning away from the mere appearances of virtue, the opinions of virtue that we all have and all apply in our lives and make decisions
right.
on the basis of, turning sort of away from those or in a sense through those to the
yeah.
being of
I
virtue.
I like through better because,
yeah.
I mean, just
yeah.
from what you yourself are arguing in
yeah.
the introduction, it's really, there's something important about the fact
yeah.
that Socrates always starts with,
yeah.
he's always starting with what do you think about something?
Exactly.
Like, how
yeah.
are you orienting
yep.
yourself toward these questions?
Yep. Yep.
And then testing that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, and I think, so I in the first chapter of the book, in trying to argue against what I see as a kind of a general tendency, a sort of presupposition or bias in the orthodox approach to the early dialogues, I offer an interpretation of the role of doxa in
mm-hmm.
the early dialogues. So that's what Socrates always is asking, right? How does it appear to you?
Right.
How does it, docain, how does it appear or seem to you?
Right.
What's your doxa of
mm-hmm.
Sophrosune, Charmides? Those questions are the ones Socrates... So I think if you work back through the etymology of doxa, what you get is, well, you get back to docain, which means both to opine, but also to seem or appear.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And that's related ultimately as an iterative form or a repetitive form to the verb dekestai, which means to receive.
Mm-hmm.
So what you end up with Socrates' thematization of doxa and his beginning from doxa is when we take that very seriously, what we realize is that Socrates is no kind of modern philosopher. He's not operating on the assumption of a subject-object relationship, where the doxa, the original appearance or the original opinion, the initial pre-philosophical opinion, is something that might potentially be cut off from or radically severed from the way things are, from reality, right? Mm-hmm. There isn't any merely subjective appearance for Socrates. There are more or less obscure appearances, more or less obscure opinions. And so if you begin from an opinion or doxa, you know that by clarifying that, you can clarify what virtue is.
Well, I mean, in that sense, really, it's a tradition that gets handed down to Aristotle in a way that's very important. I mean, if what you're saying is right, and I think it is, it's not that Plato... We're still talking. Yeah. I want to be clear. We'll talk about Socrates, not Plato. But still, that the caricature is that Plato rejected the appearances in favor of that which exists permanently beyond them. And what you're reminding us is, what we know about putting this character in these dialogues is that character, Socrates, is embedded always in a situation that has to take seriously the context in which he finds himself and the opinions that face him at the time.
That's right.
And that's sort of the... And I take that to be part one of the ways in which this is that the modern atomic independent subject, divorced divorced from the context and the situation, would close that possibility off. And the other thing that I think is critical about what you're saying is that the appearances themselves show the nature of things, right?
Yeah, so that's
our access to being.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, the appearances are always real appearances of what virtue is or what courage is. So if we begin from your opinion or the way courage appears to you, by clarifying that opinion, by analyzing it, by working through it, we know that we are, everything we talk about, everything we do in that discourse is connected to already what courage is. We don't have to worry about establishing a connection to reality the way we do after Descartes,
right?
That's the whole modern philosophical project, is how in the world can we assure ourselves that what we're thinking, what we're arguing, what we're philosophically thinking, how in the world can we assure ourselves and become certain that that is connected to what is, to reality, right? And that, I think, so this then gets us back to the strangeness of Socrates.
Right.
I think that if the early Socrates, and it's just the early Socrates that I focus on in the book, but I think this characterizes Socrates.
Probably the character of Socrates throughout. I mean, you should mention, you should say some things about early, middle, late, and all that kind of, because you have been using the shorthand of early. You probably, if I pressed you, you probably would say it's these aporetic moments, the moments where Socrates is a central character.
Yeah.
And actually, that's where I'm really focusing my attention in trying to delineate the nature of what Socrates is up to politically by paying attention to how he performs politics with those he encounters, and that means in those dialogues, the same kinds of dialogues. But you're not not embracing a the traditional early, middle, late kind of.
I don't embrace it, but I do think So what we could say about it is that there is it has a kind of double support, that is the stylometric analysis, whatever you think of that. You know, there are stylometric analyses of the dialogues, analyses of various word parts and word usages and forms that use utterly different criteria,
right?
And that come up with more or less the same rough divisions.
Right.
You know, all the aporetic or Socratic dialogues kind of grouped at the beginning, then on the at the divisions, there's always a little bit of unclarity. You know, is this one then in the early or in the middle period or something? But more or less, you always get the same early dialogues, the same middle dialogues, and the same late dialogues. So that's one support, is that stylometric, that Sprachanalytique. But on the other hand, you've got substantive analyses that have argued or have tried to argue that, well, Plato's thought seems to develop in some sense. It seems to move from a Socratic project that is more aporetic to one that is more positive in its statement. In some sense, it comes up with theories of the relationship between appearance and reality that aren't articulated in the early dialogues, and some role for ideas that doesn't seem to be there in what we generally take to be the early dialogues. And then we have a kind of self-critical phase in dialogues like the Parmenides and the Sophist, even the Timaeus, where it seems like Plato's criticizing some of his, you know, what seemed to be articulated in the middle period. So what I would say is, in general, I don't have a problem with the standard ordering and the chronological ordering, but on the other hand, it's not important to my interpretation.
Right. You know?
So what I'm interested in is the project of that Socratic project,
right,
that aporetic project,
right,
and that is also then returned to in the Theaetetus, and you know, it's
right,
and it has different moments, even in those dialogues we think of as the middle dialogues,
right,
really. And that project for Plato, that's the one I'm interested in, trying to figure out what conception, what does Plato understand to be the status of the being of virtue, the subject matter of Socratic questioning regarding virtue, if the question is the proper way to bring the being of virtue to light.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of ontology does that leave us with,
mm-hmm,
right? Because it can't be an ontology of presence,
right,
because any present entity is, right, can be and in principle can be properly and fully revealed in a propositional definition.
Right. Well, I mean, and this relates right to, I mean, let me just pause a second and talk about the early Middle Ages just a moment, because part, one of the issues there, and I totally agree with you and take your point that the not much depends on, this doesn't, not much on, of your reading depends on this. But what I find interesting about it is that, you know, that still makes us obsessed with Plato.
Right.
Rather than with what is expressed in the dialogues themselves, right? So focusing on the character of Socrates as he appears in the dialogues really sort of can get us out of that circle. Like, was this early, middle, or late? Well, okay, that doesn't quite matter so much as dramatically what's happening, where is this happening in Socrates' life, and why Plato. Then it does relate to Plato insofar as he himself chose to articulate and express this character in these ways, So, and actually, I know we'll hear tonight, tomorrow night, Catherine Zucker talk about it. So, and her take is to read it from a narrative perspective. Her take on how to read Plato is how to read it from that narrative, take it in terms of Socrates' own life, which is, I think, compelling in many ways.
Yep.
But I want to go back, and because this is directly related to some of the things I'm interested in with regard to Socrates, maybe we could focus a little bit on your reading of the Apology, because, and I think it was—it's really was the part that I read. I read, I guess it's chapter two, of it was really interesting because of the way that you on the you show how in the Apology is important because it on the one hand is where Socrates describes his activity of philosophy, what he's up to. And in so describing, he shows this frustrated dimension of questioning, how questioning always has to be oriented toward that which in a certain sense escapes us.
Right.
And yet we are compelled. And he sees himself as ontologically compelled to pursue that question. And on the other hand, and this was, I thought, really nicely done, insisting that he's performing this in the Apology itself, so that you have to really read the Apology as a dialogue. And that's actually where so I want to talk about the description and the performance part first, but then I'm moving toward this larger question for me, which is for me important, which is what happens when Socrates no longer is focused on turning the soul of the individual he's talking to to turning toward the many that he has to talk to in the Apology, which he predicts he's going to fail at in the Gorgias, maybe there. So I want to think about that. That one of the dimensions of Socratic politics that I'm interested in is that it's focused on an individual and on the and on the turning of an individual. And then maybe by extension on others of us. And this is another point that you make in the book, which is, we are to learn something from reading these. So maybe let's go back to the doing, description, and the performance first, and then
the
maybe
Apology,
move in in the Apology, and then move in.
That sounds like I think we're in lockstep on the Apology. It sounds like we have a very similar approach and a similar focus.
Yeah.
We're focused on similar issues.
Right.
And I do think that's a somewhat rare perspective on the Apology. At least the recognition that that
it's good to find somebody who agrees with because we have to battle everybody else on this one. Go ahead.
I think it's true that because I think there is a there's a tendency to see the question becomes for readers of the Apology. I think the question often becomes: is Socrates giving legitimate arguments for his in his own defense?
Right.
Does he imagine himself to be making, or is he engaging in rhetoric in some traditional and more or less thoughtlessly defined sense, which would be sort of not really concerned with true argumentation or the truth at all, but rather simply putting forward arguments in order to achieve some kind of end, some kind of result, persuasion, or something like that. And then there's also the question that comes even from Xenophon: is Socrates interested in defending himself at all, or is he, you know, is he suicidal or something? Which seems kind of absurd to me, that old debate. But so what I think is interesting that I think we would probably both agree on is that if we take this radical project of Socrates seriously, that he is aiming at aporia. He's not aiming at some condition beyond aporia, even as an ideal.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not aiming to produce knowledge. He's not aiming to arrive at a definition. He's aiming at the aporia that always is the result. He's aiming at that recognition of finitude.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If that's the real aim of Socratic philosophizing, mm-hmm. that is an indefensible activity. You can't, in a positive sense, that is, it's Socrates can't give a positive defense of that activity with regard to human virtue.
Right.
Because in order to argue this activity is good, or this activity should be respected by the city, or this activity should be, you should all reward me or thank me, in order to really make that argument, what Socrates needs to do is to say, I know what the good is.
Right.
I know what virtue is. I know what's right and what's wrong.
Right.
I have that knowledge that I've my entire life and still here am insisting that I don't have.
Yeah.
The knowledge of anything of any importance.
Right.
Socrates, in order to positively argue in justifying the activity that to which he's devoted his life, he would have to claim to have that knowledge that he disavows having.
Right.
Therefore, his defense has to proceed by other means. I think he is engaged in an apologein, a speaking away of the charges, but it has to proceed by other means, and that means engaging in a kind of quasi-Socratic dialogue with the audience,
right?
So it becomes a kind of elenctic rhetoric, I refer to it as.
You did.
Which is a weird phenomenon for precisely the reason that you pointed out earlier, that the elenchus is so entrenched in
the turning of an individual,
and in that individual's opinions,
which
we get focused on even from Vlastos's the say what you believe requirement,
or
the doxastic constraint for Hugh Benson, but that idea that you have to own those opinions, and then we see, you know, no hypotheticals, no abstract notions. What's your opinion of courage, and then we'll analyze that, so I can turn you.
And that's where Socrates gets his toehold, and he moves people. But and I think it does. I mean, from my perspective, it's really interesting what happens when he has to address an audience.
Yeah.
And why, you know, not only so then there's not only the failure that is inevitable in all Socratic questioning of what virtue is, but there's like another level of inevitable failure because there aren't these toeholds that he can get to turn the audience. Although he does, I think that, I mean, he did turn some people. I mean, it wasn't like a total rout, So he was actually pretty surprised at how many he did get convinced.
Yeah.
But I want to go back for a second because the way you formulated something got me thinking about the notion of the aim of Socratic questioning. Because you were saying that the aim is the aporia, and I wonder if I wonder what the role of what I would call these erotic principles are. So erotic principle of the good, the just, the beautiful.
Yeah.
And I say them at those as erotic principles or erotic ideals because they're always elusive.
Right.
And yet there is a way in which our orientation to them pulls us through the doxa.
That's right.
And into a deeper understanding of something, a deeper understanding of how we are, how we might be together, and yet even without giving us that sort of dreamed, which might be a nightmare, of absolute knowledge of it.
That's right. Yeah, that's and I like that idea, the erotic principles. I refer to them in the book as excessive measures.
Yeah,
The same. Yeah, sure. It's the same basic idea. That's what the erotic is trying to communicate.
Right.
You know,
right.
But you're directed toward them. You're striving for them. You when they present themselves to you, the response is eros, right? The good, beauty, etc. Your response is to be drawn toward them, to find wherever they appear, that's the choice worthy, etc.
Right.
So I think that the I like that very much. I think what my idea is that the sense that the proper way to for humans to relate to those erotic principles, those excessive measures.
Yeah.
The sense that the proper way to relate to those principles would be a techne, a skill, a craft of virtue, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is something that I believe Socrates finds in the everyday attitude itself. That is, we have a sense that we should know these things. Mm-hmm. Everyone is utterly embarrassed to admit that he or she doesn't know them, right? Socrates is the only one, and then whenever he does admit it, everyone says, you know, Meno says, "What are, is this what I'm really to report home to the people at home, Socrates, that you don't know what virtue is?" No one will admit, and Gorgias, in the Gorgias, they say, well, you know, no one can admit not to knowing what these virtues are.
Right.
What, you know, everyone has to claim to know them, because it would be absurd not to know them, or to admit to not knowing them. So there's a sense that we should all have a more or less satisfactory grasp of those things. That is, a techne-like grasp of those things, even if we wouldn't always articulate it as a techne or use that term. So I think Socrates finds that tendency towards a technical or a techne-like grasp of those erotic principles in the everyday attitude.
Right.
We presume to already be grasping them satisfactorily.
Mm-hmm.
Socrates' task is to disrupt that that presumed grasp and to show us that, in fact, our proper, if always painful, always frustrated, but our proper human relationship to those things is the striving for them and failing, the striving to grasp them and failing to grasp them.
Right.
But that, I think, is what Socrates, that condition is precisely what the dialogues present as aporia. And so in that sense, it's the aim of Socratic the Socratic method or Socratic philosophizing, insofar as that aporetic condition is the really the proper way of relating to those erotic principles. That's the condition of desiring those principles, the aporetic.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so Socrates always to uncover that relationship that we're normally.
So that brings you, us to the whole your analysis of pathé and that you laid out in that chapter. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because there is this sort of undergoing.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so So what I try to argue is that aporia that Socrates tries to bring about, that is a kind of a truthful pathos. That is, it's a suffering of the what I like to talk about in terms of excess or distance. It's a suffering of that distance of virtue, that ontological distance, that irrecoverable, unbridgeable kind of distance. It's the suffering of that recognition, or the suffering that goes along with that recognition. So it's not merely epistemological, You suffer that withdrawal.
You have to feel. I mean, you experience. You undergo it in that full embodied sense. You're frustrated, and it's not a nice feeling. Sometimes you're reading these dialogues, you're like, "Oh man, And he's worried, obviously, about that in the Phaedo and elsewhere, where he's worried about mythology.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's what and I think that frustration is what we today talk about more in terms. What he talks about is mythology. We talk about today more in terms of relativism, right? We end up in a kind of relativism where.
I think he's got. I think we, with those, with excessive measures, with erotic principles, that's in a certain sense what's avoiding the charge of relativism,
right,
in a contemporary,
right,
sense,
yeah,
because you actually are being held accountable by,
right,
these ideals in a certain,
yep,
way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just when you begin to delude yourself into thinking that you could actually possess them,
right,
and
right,
then not only delude yourself into thinking you possess them, but then,
yeah,
pretending that you, professing that you do,
right,
possess them,
right, right,
that,
right,
we run into,
yeah, yeah,
real dangers.
That's right.
And politically, too.
Yep.
And so that's why I feel like the strategy that Socrates is taking when he says in the Gorgias, you know, I'm the one who's practicing the true political techne,
yeah,
and
yep,
or the political techne truly,
yep,
and
yep,
so that, or trying my hand at,
yep,
and that's why I try to make a big deal about that,
yep,
because it is in the trying one's hand,
yep,
that you can,
yep,
you have to perform it,
yep,
you have to live it, you can't,
yep,
just talk about, well, it's just going to end in aporia, and I'm,
right,
going to sit back.
Right.
And just tell you that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's not going to be... You're not going to learn what you need to learn.
Right, right.
Right.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, yeah, and I think, yeah, that is important that for Socrates, if the proper way of grasping or relating to those as you call them, erotic principles...
We can use excessive measures.
No, I like erotic. I like introducing the erotic, and, you know, that's always good. So, if a pathos, right, a suffering of their withdrawal, a suffering of their distance, but it's not an emotion, right?
Right.
It's not anything like a passion in some merely subjective emotional sense, right? It is always a way of being connected to,
right,
those,
right,
already connected erotically,
right,
to,
right,
those measures, right,
right,
to those principles. If a pathos is the way in which you relate to those things properly and truthfully, right? The way,
right,
they reveal themselves as they are, which,
right,
is...
Which is excessive, erotically,
calling to you,
elusive.
Yep, exactly.
Exactly.
That's the moment of truth for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's how you grasp them truthfully in recognizing your failure to grasp.
Right.
If that's the case, then you can't relate to them truthfully in the abstract or in,
right,
an uninvolved way.
Right.
You can't sit outside the discussion, the Eclectic discussion, and say, oh, I get it. They're always in excess of what we think or what we believe. You can only...
Yeah. So in these erotic principles themselves is the provocation to engage in their...
Exactly.
In their search.
Exactly.
Or in their questions.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. I think when they present themselves to you, if you have any sense of what beauty is, if you can say... Or if we posit someone has an experience of,
yeah,
beauty, someone has an experience of the good,
right,
we posit that person as being drawn to,
right,
beauty, drawn to the good.
Right.
If they're not drawn to it, then we have to call it something else, right? It belongs,
well,
to,
but,
the very,
I mean,
notion.
So, I mean, are you I think you're suggesting here somehow a kind of, well, I don't know if it's an argument, but it's,
mm-hmm,
an account that would say, you know, that attitude that is completely deflated by your frustration,
right,
for all these conversations we've been having,
right,
for our whole life and never getting to the answer,
right,
of what,
yeah,
is, you know,
right,
is you know, temperance or,
right,
courage or whatever,
right,
and if your attitude after all that is, you know, a kind of withdrawing of the question, forgetting questioning, giving it up,
right,
you know, receding into I don't know what kind,
right,
of life, you that would be a failure to do justice to the phenomena themselves, to
that's
these,
right,
to what,
that's
these,
right,
virtues are.
Absolutely, yeah, that would be a kind of deadening, obviously, on your part, a kind of becoming numb to the appearance of beauty, the,
mm-hmm,
appearance of the good, right?
Right,
not being drawn to them, not being urged along by,
right,
their appearance, which is what they should,
right,
do, right? That's their,
right,
and so there would be a kind of numbing to those,
yeah,
things that would go along with it, or and so that would be like you said, a not doing failure to their initial phenomenality, right?
Right,
which is always appearing in such a way that draws you toward them.
Right.
So specifically for Socrates, virtue, beauty, and the good. Those are the three things that when they, and all the different aspects of virtue, courage, sophrosyne, his idea is always, and his arguments always presume, if these things appear to you, they appear as choice-worthy, as good. If you say, well,
right,
is courage a choice-worthy thing? Is courage a desirable thing? Socrates will say, well, obviously we've gone astray. We're not talking about the same thing anymore.
Right.
For any virtue to appear, courage to appear, it's something that draws you toward it. And so if you're no longer addressed by that thing and drawn toward it, that means either you presume to have perfect knowledge of it, that's or at least satisfactory knowledge of it. That's the condition of the many, of all three of the the classes that Socrates questions in the Apology. That's the condition of basically everyone, right? Except when you have a moment of crisis, or except when you have a moment of Socratic crisis on the streets of Athens when he accosts you and asks you about your opinion of something, right? That's the moment when suddenly, oh my God, I don't know what I presume to know, right? And that's the moment then that you would feel that urge, being urged by virtue, being urged by the good, being urged by potentially beauty, to seek it, to strive for it, to become, to properly relate to it, to do it justice.
So, I mean, now I'll just play, when we talk about it in these terms, and this is, my question here is leading to the question of the tragic, and then ultimately maybe to the comic nature of some of the Socratic, but there's something perverse here that's at work, right? So that, like, you're drawn to the beautiful, you're drawn to the good, you're drawn to exactly that which you cannot possess in the way you wish you could possess it, and really what you're really involved in is being drawn to these things and constantly recognizing, I can't, right? And and then you're asked even more perversely to not be deflated by that, like, to just repeatedly go do that, and
that's
like... yourself to this.
That's right.
Right.
That's
And all in the name of some kind of self-knowledge, which we're smiling and laughing here, but it is there's what I've described in a certain sense is the tragic.
Right.
What I love about Socrates is that he doesn't allow it just to be tragic.
That's right.
The dimension of humor, the dimension of playfulness.
That's right.
Which I think also comes with the erotic when we're oriented in the right way.
Right.
Happens.
Yeah, I think that's right, and probably it's that combination of the tragic comic that allows Socrates to, or that Plato seems to present us with as a kind of antidote to mythology, a kind of antidote to relativism, a kind of a playful way of inhabiting that constantly frustrated space that makes it tolerable in some sense, right? That constantly being made painfully aware of one's own finitude, of one's lack of precisely that knowledge that one recognizes one needs most.
That's
the condition that Socrates wants you to constantly return to, or in his case, he seems to be the rare instance that Plato holds up to us. Socrates seems to be in that condition all the time, right? Socrates is the one person that doesn't ever seem to have any opinions about what virtue is or about anything of any importance, right? He knows what a sphere is, or he knows what, what clay is or something. But he doesn't know anything about virtue, anything of any importance. He's the one person that seems to be living in that self-conscious ignorance all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what Plato does want, so I agree that there is a kind of a tragic element to what's being asked of us, and by Plato, especially in the early dialogues, but I would say throughout Plato's corpus.
Sure.
And then, and that there is a kind of a comic antidote to the negative aspects of that, or the intolerability of that tragic awareness, right? But I would also say that for Plato's Socrates, the reason to find yourself in that condition, the reason to by which you end up in that condition, is never because you think that condition is good, or because you think the aporetic condition is desirable, or something like that.
Right.
The reason that you end up there is that you presume inevitably in your everyday life, because no one is Socrates. So we all fall back into doxa. Right. We all fall back into our everyday average opinions of things, and presuming to know virtue and the good and et cetera, making decisions in our lives. And so Socrates' idea, it seems to be, or Plato's Socrates' idea in the early dialogues at least, seems to be, well, philosophy is that practice by which you constantly call into question your own presumption to know. And in that activity, you find yourself in that aporetic condition, right? That calling into question. But that should be the reason that you question it is nothing other than the desirability of knowing what you're seeking to know, the desirability of knowing the good, the desirability of relating properly to the good, right? So that's always the motivation. It's never right. So it's the reason why do you engage in philosophical questioning? The reason is, well, because something presented itself as question worthy.
Right.
That's the reason, right? It's never because philosophy makes me happy, or because philosophy gives me a pleasant life, or because there isn't any reason to engage in philosophical questioning.
Well, I mean, there's a way in which the philosophical activity is a response to the existential condition of human being, right? So that things present themselves as question worthy.
That's right.
We are the kinds of beings that
can
ask questions
that.
Are addressed by that, right, and can respond.
Yeah.
But Socrates himself says at certain points, he says in the Phaedo and other places, I'm in danger of becoming unphilosophical about this.
Right.
He does seem himself to sometimes get caught up in the desire to win an argument or to, there are ways. I always hesitate because I always, want to resist the temptation to make him into this kind of idealized figure.
Yeah.
And there are ways in which he misses points, I think he sometimes doesn't do justice to what somebody's saying. I think in the Protagoras, I don't know if I'm talking about it in the paper tomorrow, but there's a point where Protagoras is trying to be a little subtle about some distinctions he's making about the virtues, and Socrates is like, well, he's really holding his feet to the fire in this really way that I think isn't very generous.
Yeah.
So he does that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think the larger point is really that he's animated by the recognition that we have to that in the searching for what is just is the moving toward it in a certain way.
That's right.
And
the
aporetic mode in which we find ourselves as a result is also something that we have to acclimate ourselves to and figure out how to exist in.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I think that the Socratic is a practice that allows us to inhabit that space. In a way that hopefully through constant provocation, that's all Socrates really has ultimately to get over the mythology or relativism, is by undermining my certainty, Socrates can show me that I'm already being addressed, being called by the good, by beauty, in a way that I find compelling, He can't make an argument as to why I shouldn't be a relativist.
Right.
He can't make an argument as to why I shouldn't be a misologue,
right?
The only thing he can do is to try to undermine the opinions and hope that in that loss of certainty, in that loss of presumed knowledge, I feel addressed by what's question-worthy about the good, about virtue, about beauty.
So, one of the points you make early on is, what is Socrates teaching us? Or taking seriously the idea that now we, reading these texts, are involved in the process of self-knowledge and drawn into it in a kind of way that I guess, and maybe this is the point of this question, is different from the character in a dialogue. Right?
Yeah.
So now we see, as readers of these texts, we are involved in a way, and yet not involved in the same way as the character in a dialogue is.
Yeah.
As Gorgias is when he talks to Gorgias, or as Charmides is, or as Euthyphro, or any of these characters. Right?
Yeah, that's right. I think there is a different way in which we're addressed by Socrates' questioning.
Right.
That even I suppose different than the audience members we hear about sometimes their reactions.
Right.
For instance, in the Phaedo.
Right.
Or even in the Charmides, there's
audience people around.
There.
Yeah. Sure.
And we're addressed by that activity differently. And so my idea is that, because Socrates and because Plato's Socrates has such a determining role on our understanding of ourselves, on the tradition that we inherit, on the traditional concepts and categories and themes and images even with which we organize our experience of our world and ourselves and one another, we're always already sort of speaking a Socratic Platonic language of a certain kind, right? It's one that's been passed down, and I think reified, and I think, and most importantly, I think the strangeness has been lost.
Right.
I think the really weird character of Plato's Socrates has been sort of watered down, so that now we have someone that, when we read the dialogues, a lot of times initially they seem to be it seems to be a fairly recognizable project that Socrates. It's not about that radical exposure of finitude, the exposure of the aporetic moment, the ungraspability of what virtue is in and of itself.
Right.
So we don't feel that as so much.
Right.
And so my idea is that our relationship to that Socrates helps if we can sort of emphasize the moments, so as a reading practice, if we can sort of emphasize the moments of strangeness, the moments that don't fit with our expectations, with our presuppositions, And once we have that, I think then Socrates ends up serving for us through our historical lens, something like his original purpose, He destabilizes our, he gives us reason to question, to be suspicious of the sort of knee-jerk assumptions we make, the presuppositions we're imposing.
And the lenses through which we read his own text,
Exactly.
So those, and that's the point I think you were trying to make about this hermeneutics of strangeness, hermeneutics of...
Estrangement.
There you go.
That's right. And it'll catch on.
It will. Hermeneutics of estrangement. That'll be the title for the podcast here. What I think is really compelling about that whole that approach is that it undermines that what is Socratic refutation, what is the Socratic method, let's systematize it, this is what he does, does this. Well, of course, it always is thwarted because you'll find instances where he's doing something completely different.
That's true.
And that's part of the point, which is that he will be responding to the person that he's encountering.
An immersed way of thinking, an imminent way of thinking. That's absolutely
And it and it can't be systematized in a way that you wouldn't that it wouldn't have to be practiced.
Right.
You have to know what it is. You have to begin to practice it. And in fact, that's part of the impetus behind trying to do a podcast like this is to think about how these technologies are impacting the way in which we communicate with one another, and also to try to perform, the excellences of dialogue, where there may be disagreements or whatever, but we're talking things through and learning how to, you know, live in that tension of disagreement. Although today we haven't disagreed much.
But there is always at least a sort of a difference of perspective, and a difference of emphasis that always illuminates things.
And what I like about this is that first of all, the auditory dimension of a podcast is, I think, important, but also the fact that you and I are talking face to face. Now, sometimes I do this through Skype and other things, but it's nice at a conference like this where we get a chance to sit down.
That's right.
And there's something really, I think, interesting about how when you turn a microphone on and when you have this kind of audience, even though the audience is not there, there is a performative dimension to what we're doing. This isn't what we wouldn't be saying exactly these words to one another.
That's right.
If it weren't on.
Right. No, that's right. Yeah, it does. I don't know. I think probably what it seems to me to bring, just speaking from the experience, I've never done it before, but it seems to bring a little bit of intensity. It just intensifies things. You have to be a little more circumspect. You want to be a little more circumspect, right? That's probably
it's the performative. Exactly.
You know?
Is it the dimension of the publicness? I mean, I found that it's been interesting to see that. You know, I've done these with colleagues and other things, even with Rick, with Glenn Lawler, others, and we'll have conversations, but then we'll say, okay, we're going to get together, we're going to do this podcast, and maybe it's because I've read some of their work, and we're talking about philosophy in a specific way, but it becomes a really powerful conversation from my perspective, because of the dimension of the public, or just maybe the kind of commitment to one another to have a discussion about this.
But it's probably, it seems to me to be both of those things, that the podcast element does, the idea that there is this not visible, but there is an implicit audience to the conversation, it seems to, it brings a level of responsibility, a kind of ethical responsibility almost. You have to try and address yourself to the subject matter with this other person, you know, and in a, as a kind of a mutual effort, you try to do justice to that subject matter for those people that are implicitly here.
This happens all the time, as we mentioned, in the dialogues, where Socrates is talking to an individual, with this silent audience, and sometimes comes in, as in the Protagoras, they'll intervene certain ways, but... And the Gorgias, they're there. Yeah. They don't really enter, but there's others around,
So that's right. Yeah,
it's that kind of the presence of a public,
right? Right.
has a, maybe that's an important dimension of Socratic, what Socrates is up to, namely that it, even though it is oriented toward individuals, it's still, it takes its dynamic, or its dynamic is determined to some degree by a lot of, by the silent observers or participants.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, that's, that must be right, that there, that in, it must belong essentially to Socrates' philosophical aims, right? His philosophical project, that it take place in public spaces, right?
Well, and even when in the Phaedrus, when he's there, but he'll make nature itself the public,
right?
So
that's
it becomes, the Platanos tree and all these things. It is true that there are dialogues where it's just one. And the other, the other aspect of this is just kind of occurring, but that's good. Is that Socrates himself is a silent participant in certain dialogues, statesman and others, So that's an interesting, just the presence of him. Add something.
I haven't
thematized what it adds yet, but it's something.
Yeah, but that's certainly right. Plato makes it explicit, right?
Right.
And it has to be. I find that as an interpretive principle with Plato, it's best to assume that nothing is without significance.
Yeah. Good old Strauss's logographic necessity. Yeah, I'm more up for that.
Because what you find, Plato's an author that really seems to reward that.
So
everything
new dimensions of the text always emerge. So. Well, Sean, thank you for joining me on the Digital Dialogue. It's been great.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris. I had a nice time.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.